Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land, this land's first storytellers. I pay respects to their elders and to the elders of all communities and cultures across Australia. My name is Sophie Braham. I'm a TV writer and such a good friend of my guest John Safran that I was savagely edited out of the final draft of his book. And I'm clearly totally over it. But I am so pleased that you've decided to hit play on this Melbourne Writers Festival podcast about a book that is such a hit, it has reached, and this is true, number 25 on Amazon's list of best-selling children's books. Suck it, The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Yes, that's right. We're about to dive into the tangled world of John Safran's puff piece. This will be sort of like a classic Writers Festival event, except there's no punitive booking fee, and you can half listen while you're cleaning out the pantry. So obviously lower your expectations. Welcome, John.
Hey, how are you, Sofo?
I'm good.
Can I call you Sofo?
Of course.
Or do you feel like that's like we're in a professional setting and that's me sort of pulling the rug out from under you by referring to you in a casual way? You're going to be going, if I was a man, you wouldn't call me that or whatever.
No, I like it because it makes me sort of seem Aussie and relatable.
Okay, yes.
How annoyed are you that this isn't a public event and no one can see how skinny you've gotten?
Yeah, it's furious. And why could this could also be a video event, but somehow the Melbourne Writers Festival, they really, really want people to have in their mind their previous memory of me when I was 10 kilos heavier.
Yeah, some schlub. Well, just to paint the picture, your jaw is very chiseled. Your features are really popping.
I know. It's like when I'm like, is it Seth Rogen? I look like people say I look like him, and I'm just, that's when I go, that's it. I'm hitting the gym.
Yeah, when I went in my phone.
No carbs. Carbs for 2 months.
In my phone, any photos always suggest they always recognize you as Seth Rogen. Sorry to say. Anyway, I'll just start by saying how much I loved your book. And it's truly not just because it's so rare to see an Australian book by a funny person that isn't just a disgusting children's book about bums or farts, but there was a bit about pissing in your shoes in the book that made me physically shudder, but we'll get to that in a bit.
Yep.
But this puff piece is a truly remarkable book about this strange cultural moment that we're living in. To the extent that we ever know our own motivations, why did you decide to tell this particular story?
A couple of the layers of why I did. One was just curiosity, like as a person, as a John Safran who's not a book writer but in a parallel universe, working in some office or at the 7-Eleven and finding out about this and wanting to know more. And what that was, I mean, we'll keep it really tight. But what it was Philip Morris, the Marlboro people, saying they were going to shut down as a cigarette company and relaunch as a health enterprise. I was like, what? And so I just kept on wanting to dig away at that first to see whether it was true, then suspecting it wasn't true, but wasn't true in a very complicated way. Like it wasn't as simple as, you know, it's not really like the equivalent of McDonald's saying, oh, we've got this, we're now healthy. And you're like, yeah, bullshit. You know, we can all see that grease still kind of soaking through the cardboard in the Big Mac box or whatever. And so then I started chasing it. And then I was so curious as to why no one else was chasing this story, because it seemed incredible. And then I started going mad. Is this not a story? Am I like mad or something? Like, how can I be the one person on the planet chasing this thing where the world's biggest cigarette company, so responsible for 8 million deaths a year, or the biggest player in the industry responsible for 8 million deaths a year, and then them claiming they're relaunching as a health enterprise, when really what they're doing is introducing this new product, which isn't a vape, by the way, and they're claiming it's not a cigarette, except it sure as hell looks like a cigarette, and they're using it in jurisdictions like the whole of Europe, for instance, where cigarettes are banned. So where menthol cigarettes were banned across Europe last year, they introduced this new product to get around it, which is a cigarette, and they just have reworded it. And I was like, how? They were like in the jaws of defeat or whatever that expression is. And then it was like the beginning of the end for them, for this, the biggest health crisis in the world, which, you know, it's like menthol cigarettes banned in Europe, so that means it's going to go onto all cigarettes banned in Europe. And they just figured out a way around it by reintroducing a cigarette and just claiming it's not a cigarette. So I was like, I was just so, then that sort of became the story too, me trying to figure out whether I'm going mad. And this isn't a story for some reason that I'm not picking up on.
Did you nearly like convince yourself out of it? Were you ever at risk of doing that?
No, I don't know. Not really. Because the other thing is that, like, this is my job. You're like, you know, a bit like you, your job is in the arts, which it's cool to be a, what's the other version of it? It's cool to be a hobbyist. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's nothing wrong with that. But it's like, it is a bit different when you've bet your life, you know, where it's like, well, the way I pay for things is because, you know, I do creative work. And that's like really... So for that always drives me in a good way, if you know what I mean. Like, I just don't have the option of like leaving things off for a few extra months and everything like that. And also, once you come up with an idea that you think is, well, first of all, that you've sold to someone, in this case, Penguin, and then you think, oh my God, this could actually work. Like, this is like a, like, that's quite precious to me. It's not like I had, I mean, I can have all sorts of ideas, but when it comes to like a real one that I'm thinking, oh my God, this is, I'm going to be the first person in the world to put out the book about Philip Morris's brand new hustle that no one has put a book out. No one has written art. It's not like a feature article in the New York Times or anything like that. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, yeah. I'm because you feel like, as when you're a creative type, like there's something really cool about doing something that you feel like, oh, there's going to be a hole if I don't do it.
I think. That's so interesting because, the culture and the discourse kind of follows the same choreography and beats so often, and everyone gets excited about something and then their interest wanes within 24 hours. You have to really hold on to that thing of like, I think that even though nobody's talking about it, I think that there's something here. And it's one of the things that I love about the book, that you did do that. Like, you just followed your, sorry to be anti-Semitic, your nose.
Sorry, you just followed your hook nose because you knew you wouldn't get your gold from the goyims at Penguin Books if you didn't follow your hook nose.
Exactly. I think it's just so interesting creatively, because what a win to fulfill a contractual obligation and to give a shit about it. But I think it's really interesting, that thing where, like, when there's no Google search results on something that you care about, you're like, it's tempting to just be like, oh well, case closed. But you really followed every story, every nook and cranny of it. I loved that about the book, that you kind of shared with us what you were thinking as you're pursuing this adventure.
And I think another thing that drove me was, because the topic on the face level is not my usual wheelhouse. I think if people know about my work, they'd be going, oh, John, he's always talking about religion. He's always talking about like ethnic strife and things like that. And so, but one thing I noticed was that the backdrop to the world has changed, and now everyone's doing my beat, which is like, I remember when I did this show called John Safran versus God, and I think I filmed this in this story maybe in 2003 or 2004, and I'm hanging out with this Klansman in America, and when that went on TV, people were like, what the hell? I hadn't thought about the Klan since the 1960s. Like, what is this? It's like this whole notion of like theatrical, costumed white supremacy, and even like the notion of white supremacy in that kind of costumed kind of far right way. It just seemed like no one was really covering it or whatever. And it just seemed like so weird to people watching it. Like, it was like, I can't believe, like, what is this or whatever? And even the same with, parallel to that, the whole thing of like looking into the fringes and into conspiracy theories and things like those two things were just so the fringe of the fringe of the fringe. But now, like, the backdrop to the world has just changed, which is kind of so confusing for me.
Yes.
but where all these things that were just the fringe of the fringe are now sort of center stage, where the top stories, even like as we're talking about this, I was looking on Twitter about this political race in America, in Virginia, I think going for governor or whatever, and all the stories, like, I think the Republicans won, and so many of the stories are sort of like, oh, was he dog whistling to white supremacists? And the whole thing was being played out, and the Democrats sent these fake white supremacists to one of his rallies to either satirize it or to try to trick people into they had white supremacist story. And it was like everything, but that's just one story. I'm just saying, like, everything is just, that's like the backdrop to the
fringe became story. Mainstream.
Yeah, the fringe became mainstream.
And I feel
so therefore I was like, I have to zig whilst the others zag, as they used to tell us in the sort of TED Talks. Motivational speakers when I worked at an ad agency. And so I was thinking, like, how do I just do something that people aren't expecting? So when I realized the story ticked that box, I was also wanting to chase it. And then also I really, the two other things was, I really liked the idea of, I was talking about things I was interested in through this other thing rather than directly, which I think just makes it so much more interesting. So for instance, there's all this autobiographical stuff in there, where, like, I find out about my father on my dad's side and my grandparents and how they escaped the wars. But it's being all discussed through, in the case of that particular chapter, it was being discussed because I go to my dad. Oh, Philip Morris says they're doing good now. They're a health enterprise. But how do we weigh that up? Like, when do you forgive it? Let's say they are going for good. How do you weigh that up with the crimes that have been done in the past? And, like, can they ever be forgiven? Can Philip Morris ever be forgiven? And then it was like paralleling that with, like, companies that worked with the Nazis, like Volkswagen or Hugo Boss. And so I was discussing the whole notion, like, so on point for a book about Philip Morris. Like, if Philip Morris are now going to do good, how do we weigh that up with what they've done in the past, where they've, like, killed millions of people? And then through that, I discuss it with my dad, and then we start talking about Nazis and when, you know, and how he's had to deal with, well, you know, the Nazis did this to his father, but they did that and all this stuff like that. And so those stories were just so, those personal stories are just, to me, it just seems a lot kind of cleverer and more creatively vibey. And then like, if I was like, oh, this book is about my father.
Yes.
And sort of like again and again through the book,
well, you might get to that one when the creative world one runs dry.
Yes. and like constantly through the book, I was like trying to address all these problems with Philip Morris, but through the filters of, like for instance, going to Father Bob, who I'm sure a lot of listeners know, and going to my rabbi and asking them these questions, like, you know, if people who work with Philip Morris, are they breaking the seventh commandment of thou shalt not kill? And are they going to go to hell after they die for murdering people and stuff like that? So you have all these conversations. And I was like, oh, most people who are writing a book on Philip Morris, they just wouldn't do it this way. But it seems like a cool way to do the book.
It kind of reminds me, weird analogy, but parents always say, like, don't ask your kid how their day was at school. But if you take them in the car and ask them how their day was, they'll answer because they're not looking at you. It's kind of like the subtext is always more interesting than the text. And I feel like in this book, it's just such an interesting way of doing it because the world is so overwhelming right now, like all these big ticket issues dominating conversation, but you can understand them all through this tiny lens. It's just a really, like, interesting way of looking at the world, basically.
Yeah, and the other thing, I really feel like this is the first book where I've got it right, which, I mean, not ragging on my other books, but, and, you know, you have to
be a good pull quote for the re-releases of your previous books.
Yeah. No, I feel like I've always wanted to do this writer and also one of Sophie's friends in the real world, John Ronson, or Ronso, as she calls
him. I'm so glad that's on the public record.
And he wrote So You've Been Publicly Shamed and The Men Who Stared at Goats and Them and lots of other things. And he's done
emails to us as part of our friendship with him.
Yeah, he emails us. And then and he's done a couple of docos and a couple of a podcast series or whatever. And what I learned from him, and what I've always been sort of jealous that I haven't done yet up until this book, was he always thinks of a really good theme, of which the story he's telling is a killer example of exploring that theme, as opposed to it just being a killer story. So the one that's easiest to explain that point is he did an audio documentary, sort of a podcast series or whatever, on the gig economy and about how our lives have just been upended for lots of people because, you know, unlike 10 years ago, unlike 20 years ago, like, we're working in a gig economy and everything's going online and things like that. And so, but the way he told that story was through the porn industry and about how because when free porn was put online, I think he might use Pornhub, I don't know what. Anyway, he uses one of the big companies. As soon as they started putting free porn online and getting that market and getting that, suddenly it just upended everything for so many people, like from smaller players, like suddenly actors in those movies couldn't command as much as a fee because it's like it's for free and other people would do it for free. So it's a bit like the arts or whatever. Yes. Like I could always get someone to do it a bit cheaper or whatever. But then on top of that, even like upended, you know, establishment companies like Playboy and Penthouse and they were like rattle. And it just had all these ripple effects.
Yes.
Of all sorts. And I just thought lots of people would have just said, oh, I'm just going to do a story about porn because it's so exciting and interesting and colorful and cheeky and dangerous or whatever. And I'm just going to tell the story of all these like porn actors and whatever. But he did the story of the gig economy.
Yes.
And then used that. Like in theory, he could have done the same podcast series and just not done porn. He could have like told it through something else. And I just thought his work always does that where he kind of finds something even his thing, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is about he was really ahead of the curve. He really saw like shaming on Twitter and everything. But even in that, he was like, that was so fascinating because it's about shame. Like it's not about, I mean, it is about Twitter, but you know what I mean? Like it's about
it contains the
notion of shame and why we feel shame, what shame means. And then he uses this killer example of then this emerging social media platform, Twitter, that was being used to shame. And so I've always wanted to do that because my last couple of books, they're idiosyncratic in that there's a story and then the way I tell the story and there's all this subtext that makes it a very John Safran thing. But, you know, Murder in Mississippi is really about a murder in Mississippi. so the text is a subtext. And then the way it's idiosyncratic and fun, like I'd still read it, man, if you like me, because it's still good. But it's like it's all
it's not it's all meant this, to be an ad to not buy your other books.
Yes. And even my last book, Depends What You Mean by Extremist. I really reckon I could have done the theme thing there, but I didn't. Like that is also just sort of like telling the story about this emerging, you know, the new alt-right in Australia. And I just feel like I could have plonked a theme on top of it. And I think I kind of, in some ways, I think the themes in my last couple of books have been, you have to read between the lines a bit. Like yes. I've been a bit furtive about, because, it, you know, I don't want to over-explain things. I don't want to sound, you know, especially if you're writing a book about racism, what are you going to do? Go, anyway, it was then at the rally when the Klansmen were there and they said hurtful things about the Jews that I realized that racism is bad. Like, it's like, it just seems like a bit, like, doesn't really, I don't know. Whilst in this book, because I'd figured out this theme. I haven't even said what the theme for. So in Puff Piece, it really is a book more about the power of words. So not even like the power of spin. It gets more specific than that. It's like the power of words and like if you and how you can really bend the world to a different reality just by changing words, which is what Philip Morris does. They change the word cigarette to heat stick. They change the word smoke to aerosol. They do all these, like their game, their gambit is all kind of reconstruct reality just by substituting in words. And, you know, it just works in the most meaningful way. So I kind of, I use that as the big theme about the power of words and also how we're living through a fertile time at the moment of where people are battling over the meaning of particular words and, you know, what does it mean to be a woman, for instance, like is a trans woman a woman and things like that, and are Jews white or are Jews and just these, like we're living this fertile time where there's like a lot of battles over words and meaning, and then I use like Philip Morris's gambit as like, you know, in that John Ronson way, is like the killer example of illustrating the point.
Yeah, it really works, because I think when you nail down that broader theme, then the details really cut through. So something that, you know, really bowled me over in the book and really made me question my own apathy was this revelation that you wrote about Philip Morris's insurance scheme. Would you be able to read about that bit?
So this from the book.
Yes.
Already in cigarettes, now they're in medicinal marijuana. Philip Morris provides you with leukemia, then relieves you of the pain. It's a full-service business. Why stop there, Philip Morris? Why not get involved in life insurance? That's the joke, John? You're really going with that? No, it's not the joke. Philip Morris has actually set up a life insurance company to ease their customers from coughing to coffin. Launched in the UK in 2019, The life insurance company is named Revity. Incredibly, they will lower your premium if you move from smoking cigarettes to using the IQOS. The IQOS is the this is their new device that they claim isn't a cigarette, but is a cigarette, to cut to the chase.
So how, like, honestly, how the fuck do they get away with something like this?
I think that there's so many, like, cracks in the law. And also, they're sort of like they run ahead of everything. So they're like about, you know, they're 100 metres in front of everyone, and then they say something, and then, well, like, we have to catch up to them and I guess remain interested until we catch up to them, or else they're just going to – and by the time we've caught up to them, they've run ahead. Like, to give you an example of what I'm talking about, of how they just slither through the cracks of ambiguity is – I mean, I've got 100 things. Like, for instance, they announced in the newspapers, I found out about this because they took out a full-page ad in the newspapers saying that they were going to move from being a cigarette company to this new health enterprise with, and they had these new products and, you know, of which they're ultimately cigarettes or whatever. And about like 6 months into writing this book, I was going, hang on, isn't advertising cigarettes in newspapers, like, hasn't that like been illegal like for 20 years or whatever? And then it was like, yeah, advertising tobacco products in newspapers is against the law. But what happens if you're a cigarette company who advertises your new business plan to move on to these new tobacco products? Like, is that a cigarette ad or not a cigarette ad? And no one knows. And so they just get away with it. But they get away with it in such a consequential way of this thing. Like, you haven't been able to advertise tobacco in newspapers for 20 years or whatever, and now they have. And then furthermore, somehow done it in this way that you don't even really notice it and connect the dots that they've got away with something like that. And then they just sort of dance around the meaning of words and our, and all the ambiguities in life, like, oh, this new product, it does have the discharge that comes from it, does have smoke toxicants in it. But even though it's a discharge coming from a tobacco product that looks like smoke, maybe the percentage, the weighting of the smoke toxicants in the overall aerosol isn't enough to categorize it as smoke. And then, so therefore it's not smoke. And therefore, if governments have some anti-smoking legislation here in this or that jurisdiction, well, this isn't smoke. It's just a discharge from a tobacco product that contains smoke toxicants, but not enough for it to be smoke. So they just bring it. And who has the time in their day to kind of pick apart all that?
It's fascinating. They're like hiding in plain sight, and yet there's so many layers to the sleight of hand as well. Like, I remember seeing those ads that you're talking about in The Australian, and they were presented as an article. They said sponsored by Philip Morris at the top, but they were presented as this article about the innovation of the seatbelt and how it took society a while to get on board the seatbelt. And, you know, buried eight paragraphs deep, it's like, likewise, the e-cigarette. It's just, and there's all these like technological graphics. And yeah, I think we're, as a culture, we're so distracted by a much like shinier woke infraction or something, you know, somebody saying something on the Today Show, that we don't have time to wade through this 4D chess.
I know. I mean, I do bring that up in the book, that if like a CEO or if an executive from Philip Morris, if someone found an Instagram post of one of them and they've shot a lion on safari in Africa.
Yes.
Like, that would be like Twitter would, you know, that would be like a scandal. Yes. That would get traction on Twitter. And yet the same people.
The scandals have to be 11 at 11 for anyone to give a shit.
I know, but then the same, it's like the same people who are like in this hypothetical executive who's shot a lion, and that's like some moral infraction. Like, Philip Morris would probably have to go into PR defensive mode, and like maybe the person would lose their job, and then they'd donate all this money or whatever. Like, Philip Morris wouldn't be able to get away with shooting a Philip Morris executive wouldn't get away with shooting a lion on safari.
Yes, but the lion is called more damaging than 8 million people are.
Yeah, exactly. But it is so many kind of like little stems we could go off on. Like, things have just occurred to me since the book has come out. And I'm like, oh, I wish I'd kind of thought about that more before the book. It is amazing how Philip Morris, and I don't even think they do it on purpose. I really think God must love Philip Morris because they just keep on winning in all ways. So, for instance, the whole fact that the cigarette topic sounds so boring, not boring, but dated, like, John, it's, we heard about that in 1970. well done, John. Cigarettes are bad for you. Like, they somehow managed to leverage the fact that one way of looking at it is an old topic, but it's only one way of looking at it. It's an old topic. In another way of looking at it, it is still 8 million people die a year, and it's the biggest public health crisis in the world. To give a kind of a stat that kind of shows you how big it is, like in 2021, is that like 52 million people die of everything each year. Out of that 8 million, so 8 million out of 52 million are cigarette related, of which Philip Morris is the biggest contributor. So it's like,
it's crazy.
It's but somehow they even managed to leverage this advantage that it's like, oh, it's this dated issue we don't need to look at. And it's like, it's out of the zeitgeist but it's totally in the zeitgeist for the cancer cells growing in the bodies of the people smoking cigarettes. And it's so zeitgeisty for all those nurses that they're in the monitoring the iron lungs in the hospital. And it couldn't be more zeitgeisty for the hearse drivers driving the bodies to the cemetery. But still, somehow it just seems like Philip Morris even manages to,
there needs to be like a BuzzFeed listicle, the top 10 things that will kill you to keep people interested. But it's so, I found that like the biggest takeaway for me. It's like, I think we always blame ourselves for our own apathy. Like, we're like, oh, I wasn't listening. I'm not smart enough to understand this. And that's the lever that they're pulling. Yeah, it's a real incredible way of pulling the wool over people's eyes. It's fascinating. Like, we should edit this out. But a friend once said to me, editing a show, like, always pay attention to when you check your phone when you're editing something, because that's the bit you should cut out of the show. Whereas you always think, oh, I was just bored. I wasn't paying attention, but really it's like the thing was boring, and that's the edit that you should make. Anyway, it's fascinating. As a side note though, like, you talk a lot in the book about regulation and the marketplace with vapes and that whole world. But something that I was just curious about is, like, in my social world, everyone's smoking nicotine vapes. Based on my understanding of your book, they're totally illegal in Australia, and yet they're around. Why?
Everything's changed early October, which makes it – so let's just go before that because it's complicated. But it was illegal to buy nicotine vape juice in Australia, but it was legal for individuals, so not companies, but individuals, to buy small batches for themselves that they could import from, like, New Zealand or America. So it was, like, strange. it seemed like, well, why not just make it one or the other? I think a part of that is just the growing pains, if that's the word. Like, legislation still working itself out because it's such a relatively new sort of device, vaping devices. And yeah, just to kind of underscore this again, the vaping device is different to this Philip Morris device that we're talking about. So, which just makes it even more confusing, a confusing thing, even more confusing. And so having said that, like, I've heard, Soph, that you can buy stuff that's under the shelf at vape shops in Australia. So people still do that.
At my meat convenience store, they've totally given up and they just have the products on the front desk. It's hilarious.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But since October, whatever, there's been a change in the law where you can now, in theory at least, you can get a prescription, and I think in theory that you're going to be able to buy nicotine juice, like, from pharmacists or whatever. But generally speaking, the whole thing with vaping.
You're allowed to buy it at readings.
Yeah, readings. But just generally speaking, in the context of Australia, when it comes to, like, what are you allowed to do or not allowed to do with vaping, it seems to be a bit like, can you download?
It's like torrenting.
It's like torrent. It's like you just have to work out the little system, and there's a way to do it.
Yeah, there are people.
You can't download vape juice from your computer. I'm going to say that. But it's like, yeah, it's illegal, but it's not illegal. I mean, it's not illegal like you can't buy a gun or something like that, or you can't murder someone. It's more like,
just in the crime.
You know, you can't download Succession or whatever. It's like, yeah, well, you can. Like, you just have to be, you just have to, like, know what to do. And once you know what to do, it's pretty simple.
There will always be people who know what VPNs are, and there will always be people who can buy vapes. Yes. I mentioned before there was a very vivid shoe pissing analogy in your book, which took me by surprise. Yep. I'm too old to read it, so I'd like you to read this one too.
Yeah, this will be interesting to talk about. So I'm at a vape expo in Auckland, New Zealand, in a giant warehouse. Leaving the bathroom, dragging myself through the expo, and my foot, it feels squishy. My sock is soaked and I don't know. It's like, is it sweat? Or did I also piss in my shoe? Am I walking around in my own piss? But it just goes to show how once you've been corrupted, you're walking around and you don't even know whether you've got piss in your shoe or not. So the background to that was, and the background to that was that, I'm at the expo and it's really, I'm really ruminating my head about these little compromises, I guess, or kind of ethical things. Like I bought shares in Philip Morris so I could get access to their shareholders meeting. But, I've still paid Philip Morris. And then a vape company is putting me up accommodation in New Zealand, which was, would have cost about $1,000 for the accommodation over the week or whatever. And no, I just got to stay at their Airbnb mansion. And also they were taking me to whitewater rafting and to a winery and to Hobbiton. And then Philip Morris seemed to be dangling a junket in front of me or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I'm definitely going to take that, and whilst that was all happening, I did go to the bathroom. And anyway, I don't want to talk about it, but it was like there was splashing or whatever. And then I was just making this connection that like I'm now corrupted, like I've just done too many of these bad things. I've pissed on myself, and you kind of can't unpiss on yourself once you start making these sort of little compromises. But of course, I mean, as with my work, it's like there's different me as a person or me in that moment, that's what I was feeling. But I mean, there's another side of me where I was like, but of course this is good for the story. Like that's the kind of psychotic mental.
So you're saying you've always had piss in your shoes. I do find it interesting though, like to clock every one of those calculations that we make as we go along, like working on something, because I think those things are so often unseen, like people's loyalties to someone, why they will or won't say something or cover something. Like it was almost like, like a register for interests in Parliament. I don't know if that's the correct term, or like when someone does one of those things in the Good Weekend, like this is what I ate this week, and a food diary. Like I found it really compelling it explained how lobbying works and those sorts of kind of mystifying things by really clocking every little bit of your soul that you gave away along the way.
I hadn't really thought about it too much till now, but it's like there is this advantage of like me being telling this story, because as a storyteller, I know those little lumps and those uncomfortable things and the compromises to me just make the John Safran character in the book sort of more interesting and makes the story more interesting. So it's like I can go along and sincerely just be compromising myself and not really thinking about it. And then after the fact, compromise myself. And then while so many other writers would have to hide it or not want to bring it up, I know there's an advantage to my story to bring it up. So it's like I get to do the crime and then people get to hear about it because I know that's going to make the story better.
Yes.
So
it's interesting. It's probably like not too far removed from what Philip Morris does. Like it's like, here's who we are, like saying it, front-footing it, who they are and what they're doing. And then they can kind of get away with so much more stuff because they're just – they're just putting it right at the top of the agenda. Like this post is sponsored by Philip Morris and then here's all this other bullshit.
Very good point. There was this dude I saw on Goodreads or whatever writing a review of my book, and he just said, this is unlike John Safran's other projects, because in this one it's like in these other projects, John Safran's pulling all these stunts, but in this one, Philip Morris is pulling all the stunts.
Yes.
So Philip Morris is like the John Safran character in this book.
Yes.
Always up to shenanigans that whatever. And so.
It's a body swap.
Yeah, body swap. Yeah, it's like Friday the 13th.
Well, speaking of Goodreads, I was interested in some of the other feedback that you've received.
Yes.
Such as, you lost the right to a voice when your ancestors killed Christ. If it wasn't people of your ethnicity, there would be no big bad tobacco. Can you, like, first of all, how excited were you when you saw those comments?
Oh, it was, I was, because it was like some classic old school kind of Christian anti-Semitism. So I'm sure people listening to that are going, well, what did this person actually say? So this person is saying, who contacted me, that because my ancestors, the Jews, killed Jesus Christ, crucified him, and there's a curse. If you read the New Testament, there's a curse on all the generations of Jews. There's blood on the hands of all generations of Jews forever, including you, Sofa.
What a way to find out.
I mean, and Christians, theologians don't start. I know that's only one interpretation and there's others, but, you know, that's why, you know, that's what a lot of, you know, anti-Semites rely on, that interpretation. So what's it? So he's somehow tying that to the fact that, what? So I don't know. He's saying that can you read it again so we can understand it?
Actually, but you lost the right to a voice when your ancestors killed Christ. If it wasn't people of your ethnicity, there would be no big bad tobacco.
Oh, yeah. So therefore, that's just classic, like, anti-Semitism of, like, blaming the Jews for everything, because it's like, in what way are the Jews responsible for tobacco? You'd have to do a lot of twists and turns to kind of come up with that one, because, like in the book, I talk about the history of tobacco and how it was slavery in America and also in the Ottoman Empire there was tobacco farms. Hey, we can blame the Muslims. Maybe Pauline Hanson can get on board and go, listen, I'm trying to warn you about the Muslims. They're always up to something. In the Ottoman Empire, there they were with their slaves sort of like trying to make tobacco. Yeah, so, yeah, it's two things. It's just you get into the mind of various conspiracy theorists and anti-Jewish people with that, where somehow the Jews are responsible for you huffing on a Winnie Blue.
Yeah.
Winnie Blue or Winnie Jew? I did do that. Someone did. I did actually. I think I responded to someone's comment where they said, trust me on the Winnie Blues, because that's a line from this song I once did. And I said, more like whiny Jews, like that. So I did a pun.
Oh, gorgeous. I feel like, it's another interesting example of just everyone having their own reality, that kind of feedback. Yeah. I was concerned in the book about your alcohol and nicotine consumption throughout.
Yes.
And there was one bit that I really want to ask you about, see if we can get an exclusive. Yes. You say, so now I have 6 bottles of wine and 3 of them are very expensive. I'm too embarrassed to tell you how expensive. Just consider what I've done over my career. I've streaked through Jerusalem on TV. And then think about the fact that I'm too embarrassed to tell you about how much these 3 bottles of wine cost. I'm just hoping for, like, a ballpark figure.
Well, don't take it personally, because Jojo, the Penguin Random House editor of mine, he was also trying to get out the figure. He was curious. I've noticed this has become my new I did this thing yonks ago where I got exercised by a evangelical Christian on TV, and I'm being bashed by Bibles and I'm flapping around. And it was kind of like left, the piece was like left up in the air. Is that what happened? Like, hang on, was that real or was that acting or whatever? Anyway, I think it was hypnotism or something like that. But anyway, and everyone's always been trying to get me to sort of like corner me to get me to say it. And they sort of ask all these roundabout questions. Like, I've been asked about the exorcism about 18 times in my publicity for this book by, you know, on podcasts and stuff, where it's like, but anyway, they always ask some long and windy thing so they don't just sound like a person going, so what happened? Were you really exercising?
Doing a Philip Morris here. You're obfuscating.
I know, but I've noticed this, what was the cost of the wine is the new, what was the exorcism thing. I reckon it kind of just ruined, well, it doesn't ruin the book or anything, but it's much better not knowing.
That's true. It's like the, what did Bill Murray whisper to Scarlett Johansson in the end of Lost in Translation? Yes. You've got to leave a bit of creative mystery. It's very annoying, but it's still, I respect the creative goal. Well, I think that's just about all we have time for. Thank you, John. I hope that to anyone listening, and if you're contemplating buying the book, that this podcast helped get you over the line. It's available at readings, and the cover makes for a great Instagram story. The bright colours, you know, really cut through amongst all the Palestine-Israel infographics. But I think that we should wrap up by recreating the environment of a classic Writers' Festival Q&A. You know, there's always the awkward lag of people forming a queue to ask questions, unpleasant feedback on the mics, and the guy with the crumpler bag who's aggressively bolted to the front just to ask if you're looking for an intern. Then there's someone obviously who'll dredge up the Ray Martin thing or the exorcism thing. So I just thought I'd fabricate one question, your dream question, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
Hi, John. I don't really have a question, just more of a comment. I just wanted to say I think that you look really skinny. Congrats on the
thank blog. You. Thank you. But that would have to be like a boomer saying that because, you know, if you're a millennial, like somehow that's like
it's too body negative.
Yeah, it's body shaming or I'm saying you weren't attractive when you were fatter or whatever like that. I've really had to shake down younger people for compliments, like where it's like, and they admit that they noticed the weight loss, but there was like, listen, that's not the thing to do. I'm telling you, if you're young, anyone who's like older than anyone who's like Gen X or older, we don't care. We did not grow up in an environment where it's like, we don't want to hear that we've lost weight. We all want to hear we've lost weight. So just say it.
Try and be a woman in the post-Me Too era and try to get a compliment out of how you look. It's a fucking nightmare. But, you know, I think that you look great somewhere between a supermodel and Brian on the front of one of those cigarette packets, you know? Really, really smelt, really working for you. So thanks for tuning in. Thank you to John and thank you for supporting the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.